Well, you haven't heard me say anything for 2 days. Oh, mercy. It's hard to be quiet. I just get excited about revival, and it's not just rhetoric. I truly am thrilled to have you folks here.
Amen.
I feel like Elijah sometimes, out in the middle of the desert here, till John moved into the area, and we don't get together too much. He walked in church one night and I said, I know I should know you. We've been supporting you how many years? 5, 6 years?
12 years, 13 years.
Somewhere. I knew it was a while, but anyhow. And but we just don't get much company up here, and it's real easy to think that you're Elijah, that you're the only one standing for the truth. You folks coming in is like a fresh drink of water. It really is, and I am so thrilled. I am privileged to have the Dean Burgon Society here and to do what we can to advance the cause of the Textus Receptus, the Masoretic Text. My subject, I knew, was going to be a difficult subject. I started as soon as I got home from Marietta, Georgia last time, because I knew it was going to be a hard haul to try to come up with the... It wouldn't be so much... If I just want to stand up here and rave and carry on, I could have done that. But I knew that I wanted to be honest with the Word. Now, this presentation is going to be as much a surprise to me as it is to you. I've explained to some of you, we have had a trying week here. We had a very, very traumatic funeral. We have had a very needy family. I think it's the Lord's will that I lost my telephone today. I'm not kidding about that. I was at the point of going crazy yesterday. And just thankful that the Lord let me lose my phone, and if I don't find it, that won't hurt either. But I began to study this, and about a week and a half, well, it was last Wednesday, actually, it seems like a year ago, I had a lady stop the house. Her father had died somewhere between Sunday night and 6 o'clock Wednesday morning, and it set off a sequence of events, and I have been working with a fellow down in Tennessee who also has been interested in the Masoretic Text, BHS, and I called him up and said, Bobby, help. I said, here's all my stuff. I've already written it, but I'm no graphics guy. Will you throw it into a PowerPoint so I can impress everybody? He did. I haven't seen it yet. So we'll have fun today. My subject today is the Masoretic Text against the modern Hebrew text. What is the difference? We must always remember these bromides. Number one, scholars lie. I said that the first DABS meeting I came to. I still believe it's absolutely true. You can't trust a word they say. If they say the sky is blue, go out and look. I just don't believe this. Others repeat the lie until it becomes a fact. Once it becomes a fact, then you can't change it. The conclusions we present come from first-hand examination. This is about one half of the notes I made in preparation. We did some extensive examinations through the scriptures. I couldn't bring it all. How big is the issue? It's actually surprisingly not as big as the New Testament text, even though the Old Testament text is about 2 to 3 times bigger than the New Testament. The changes are not as significant because you're dealing mostly narrative. You're telling stories, and they're true stories, but you're accounting where things. Then you get to the prophets, and you get some more purely spiritual statements. But in general, the changes to the Old Testament Hebrew text are not as important as they go. There's 3 kinds of differences that I ran into. The forms of certain kinds of vowels. Now, in Hebrew, most of the vowels are just little dots and dashes under the letters. But there are 2 or 3 letters or vowels that hang over top of a consonant that doesn't say anything. And if they have that consonant there, it's called a plene or a full vowel. If it's not there, it's called defective. There is absolutely no difference in pronunciation. There is absolutely no difference in definition or meaning. It is just the preference of the scribes copying the thing, and it makes no difference. The presence or absence of the word "and" is just a single letter at the beginning of a word. Once in a great while, that's missing. The biggest difference that you'll find in the Hebrew text is the conversion of the word Jehovah to the word Yahweh. I am convinced that the name of God is Jehovah.
Amen.
Yahweh was a brutal pagan Canaanite god.
Yes.
And they have tried to convert the God of Israel. Well, they evolved the idea of monotheism. And they grabbed onto Yahweh and they developed him into this person. I did not originally agree necessarily that the vowels were original. The more I have studied the Hebrew text, the more I am convinced absolutely that the original Hebrew text included the vowel points. They were not added by the Masoretes. I know there were periods of Hebrew time when they did not write them necessarily, but we are convinced there are several things, there's a few things in here. Very few changes actually affect anything. How big is the issue? Some of the differences between the Masoretic text and the BHS are the result of changing of vowel pointing of the word, especially the name of God. Now, let's define some things real quick. Manuscript, handwritten, and script. Printed edition is one that's made on a printed press. Text. This is important. I don't know how many Christians don't realize that the text is not a printed thing. Just like software is not something you can touch. Software is the stuff that comes off of the disk and turns a computer from a doorstop into a thinking machine. It is not something you can touch. The text is the words that are on the paper. It's not the paper. So when we talk about the Masoretic text, which one? There is only one, because it's the words. It's not the paper. It's the word, the text of what it says. And a reading. A reading is where somebody decides to put something different than what we started with. What did I use? I just explained to Dr. Wade. This right here is the Bomberg Hebrew Bible. It's 1/4 of it. I have the rest of it up in my office. It is reprinted by the Jews. I bought this from a Jewish organization. This is the third edition of the Bomberg, or the third rabbinic Bible of Daniel Bomberg. The King James came officially from the second printed edition, or the second rabbinic edition, but the text, the Hebrew text, is absolutely identical. I also have the second Bomberg on the computer. I have the Aleppo Codex. That was the oldest handwritten copy of the entire Hebrew Bible that we had in existence. It was burned in a fire and damaged somewhere along the line, to where now it does not begin until the book of Deuteronomy. It has several other deficiencies in it. I had the Leningrad Codex. Normally, we start beating up on the Hebrew Bible by putting the Aleppo against the Leningrad, because Kittel used the Leningrad. You've already seen some of the things that Dr. Hume said. I'm not going to go back. He set the plate for me. If you'll remember that, Kittel was not a nice man. If you are going to find, if you're going to find the Hebrew text, why would you go to the Nazis to find it? That ought to give you a hint on what was going on. But Kittel used the Leningrad text, and I had the Leningrad text, and I didn't find any difference. And I said, now wait a minute here. And so I started to dig, and I know this is somewhere in the presentation, but I'll say it now and skip it then. Why did Kittel use the Leningrad text? He went to the Jewish people who had possession of the Aleppo text and said, would you give me a photographic copy? They said no. And so he said, okay. And he got the Leningrad text. It was not because scholars said it was older and better, even though now they do. It was because it was the only thing he could get. Because he could have taken copies of it that had been printed, like the Daniel Bomberg, that was virtually the Aleppo text,
But he didn't want that. He wanted the actual manuscripts. They said, you can't have it. It's been damaged. It's precious to us. We're not giving it to you. So, okay, I'll just use this other thing. So he used a manuscript that came from Leningrad up in Russia. And I had the Leningrad. I have this one right here. This is underneath here. It's big enough for a dictionary. This is the Hebrew Bible that is used by the Orthodox synagogues in this area. We have many Orthodox synagogues. I was in a Judaica store one day. The owner is a seminary-trained rabbi, but he didn't have the long curls. I said, why not? He said, I'm in business. His rabbi came in. I said, Rabbi, I said, would you show me the Bible you use, the Hebrew scriptures you use in your temple synagogue? He pointed this one. This is the one they use currently. Beautiful edition. It really is the easiest Hebrew to read that I have. I checked out. I had 7 or 8 different Hebrew Bibles. I used the letters that Dr. Waite's familiar with, other names that wouldn't mean anything to you. I looked at commentaries. I looked at lexicons, which are conversions of English to the Hebrew. I had to buy books on all the notes around the outside of the text in the Biblica Hebraica Studcadentia because they're in German and they're in Latin. And they're the ancient rabbinical notes from the Masoretes in the 700s, 800s. And I had to know how to read those in order to make the judgment calls that I was able to make in doing this. So I had to read books on the apparatus. I read books on the Old Testament criticism to try to figure it out. They lied. Flat out lied. Anyhow, what I expected to find? I expected to find significant variations between the Masoretic text and the modern Hebrew text. We see in the King James Bible versus the modern Bibles, I expected to see the Hebrew reflect that. I thought that they would just jump out at me and I would find them all over the place. You can tell by my voice, that didn't happen. So I expected to go into the apparatus and read down there that the oldest and best manuscript said this. Guess what? They didn't say that. They just didn't say anything. It was worthless. I thought, my, oh, my, I've got a problem.
Okay, that should be better than that.
There we go. So, who were the Masoretes? Why do we call it the Masoretic text? The Masoretes were a group of Jewish rabbis. They gathered in 3 general areas. They gathered in Tiberias, they gathered in Jerusalem, they gathered over in Babylon. That this is during the early Dark Ages, near the fall of the Western Roman Empire. They began to realize that if they were not careful, the Hebrew Bible was going to be corrupted. I'm sorry, they realized the Bible was going to be corrupted, and so they sat down and they set up a series of notes. They would mark the center letter on a page. They would count the number of consonants on a page. If a word started with if you got to the end of a line and the next word on the next line looked like it was a weird spelling, they would put the first letter of this word down here, up here, to say, no, that one's on purpose. We know how it looks. That's what it's supposed to say. If, by chance, through the centuries, they were convinced that the consonantal text had been corrupted, they still would not touch it. Instead, they put a little mark in it. They would put little circles over top of the word. And that little circle meant this may be the way it is written, kathiv, but over here in the margin, this is what you're supposed to read, keri. And so the keri kathiv, that which is read, that which is written. For instance, when they come to the name Jehovah, the Jewish people in Hebrew will not say Jehovah. What do they say, Brother Christian? You've been over there.
Adonai.
Adonai, which is the word for Lord. The reason your King James Bible says Lord all through the Old Testament, where Jehovah's name is because they followed the Jewish practice. Not because they copied the Septuagint. There's not one place you can demonstrate that is absolutely a direct quote from the Septuagint anywhere in the New Testament. You have some that are close, but there's not one that's absolutely from the Septuagint, and virtually every one is from the Hebrew of a straight translation. So they would read Adonai. So the Keri, that which is read, would be Adonai. That which is written would be Jehovah. Now, that's not a mistake. They did not want to say the name and have it taken in vain. But there were other words. There's one place, and I could not find it. I know where it is. It's in Ezra and Nehemiah. The word Moses appears. It's wrong. They universally, unanimously agree it's wrong, and they read another name there and whatever. But the Keri Kathai. And they would mark that to let you know to look in the margin to find it. They put in codes to protect the Keri. Masoret means to hand down. We'll skip over that. We don't have time. This looks like the Ninja Turtles. These are the Masoretes leant over their desk writing the Hebrew scrolls. If you made three mistakes, if a corrector found three mistakes, you trashed the scroll and started over again. This was an absolute exercise to protect the text. Vowel pointing, the Deuteronomy 27:8, write it very plainly. Psalm 18, verse 1, there's little changes and things, and these are things I'm not going to. I want to. That just went backwards. Okay, it was in Ezra. I can't go back. I'm not going to. Okay, Masoretic text. There is no official thing that you can point to and say, this is the Masoretic text. Again, the Masoretic text is the text that comes from this work. And the King James Bible came from the Masoretic text. Now, I'll talk about that a little more in a little while. There were two fellows. There was Jacob, who wrote and preserved and wrote commentary and said, this is the text and this is why it's the text. There was another fellow, his name was Ben Asher. I forget his first name, does it matter? Do you remember Ben Asher's first name? I don't either. We didn't know him firsthand. Brother Wake graduated the year after. But anyhow, these two fellows, they had slightly different notes around. I pulled this up. This is the Masoretic. You see, there are two big columns down the stage. One is the Hebrew text. The other is an Aramaic Targum, I believe, as I look at it. Then you see little notes. If you were close, you would see little notes in the spaces, and then there's another column that seems to run around the outside of the other column. That is commentary. That's the part that is the rabbinic part of this. Now, which reading, when you got to the Keri Kathiv, you chose is dependent on this. And this is what Ben Chaim and Ben Naphtali did. They didn't do this part. They just took that part, the Hebrew text. It is the notes they wrote around the outside that the King James translators, well, I'll get back to them in a minute, but were significant to the translation. Let me continue to go on. Ben Chaim helped Daniel Feinberg. Daniel Feinberg, using the Aleppo and 12 or 13 other, the Masoretes, came to primary text used by the, that is in this book, it is the primary text used by the King James. Chaim, and Ben Chaim, Ben just means son of, Ben Chaim was the rabbi who wrote the commentary. He edited that around the edges. This text became the standardized text of the Middle Ages. This is the text the Jews today still agree is the best one. Now, I get back to it. It's a little hard to explain. I have to say this first, is that they did, in fact, they used this one. This is the primary text that the King James translators used. Let me also say, there are one or two places where in their deliberations, just like they did with the Greek New Testament, they didn't necessarily follow this one. And that's where Gail Ripplinger comes. This is where they changed one letter. Yes, because there's three verses where they changed. Not a slave to, the King James translators were not a slave to any particular manuscript or printed edition. When we talk about the Greek text, we said they had Theodore Beza. They had several editions of Erasmus. They had several editions of the Stephanus text. They had the Complutensian Polyglot. They had the Latin Vulgate, though it was not the primary in their thing. They had a series, and all of the things they had in their own libraries. Up here, Cotton Mather is the famous witch, you know, he went to Harvard. Do you know what his final exam was as a college senior? The professors sat across the table and they began to read anywhere in the Bible in either Greek or Hebrew, and he had to give back a running translation in Latin. These guys knew the language a little better than most scholars today. I don't know a man knows any better than Dr. Waite here, but I don't think he would have stood up to that final exam. I know I wouldn't. Brother Spencer puts me to shame. He's got more education in one hand than I got in my whole body. I mean, these guys knew the text. They weren't preoccupied with TV. They didn't have all this stuff happening around them. World events was what happened in the next town. They were focused on what they were doing. They knew the languages. They had materials. They had the rabbis. They had rabbinical commentaries there. And they used them to discern the proper text. Which means that if you look hard enough, no matter what Hebrew text you say is the basis of the Bible, there's going to be one or two places where it's different. 1937, Rudolf Kittel changes the rules. His first and second editions of the Hebrew Bible, he used the Bamberg as his basis. He did not use it purely. We know better. Again, I have a friend, Bobby, that did the work that helped me here. Bobby has Kittel's first, second, and third edition. And just like we just got the 28th edition of the New Testament, Kittel's about to come out with the fifth edition of the fifth of the Kittel's, the BHQ, which will make the BHS obsolete, blah, 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 ad infinitum. But Rudolf Kittel all of a sudden trashed the Ben Asher text, picked up the Leningrad and the Ben Naphtali text, and that became the basis of the modern Hebrew Bible. Why did he change it? Already got that. Why did he change it? I just asked you why he changed it. Let's see what he did. He used the same excuse for the Old Testament as scholars for the New Testament. The oldest has to be the best. And since Leningrad was a little bit older, he said, I'll use that. That's the excuse you read in all the books. Again, the real reason was the Jews just wouldn't give him Ben Kayin, so he had to. All right. Why do they hate the Bamberg text? You know, I can't get an answer to that. I cannot find one book, Dr. Waite, that says what's wrong with it. I can't find a scholar like Bruce Metzger to ask. Nobody will tell me what's wrong with the Bamberg text. Yet, in fact, when I got this text from the rabbi, I said to him, what text is that, rabbi? He said, same one Moses got on Mount Sinai. They don't even ask questions. But I do say this. Textual scholars make two deadly assumptions, and Brother Hume said this already. They do not believe in divine inspiration, and they do not believe in divine preservation. Therefore, the Bible has human origins, it evolves, and what you have now cannot be what it started out to be, and so you just have to go back and find it. A dog couldn't have started out as a dog, so I got to go back and find a bone that looks like a cat turning into a dog. And they go scouring history to find any hint that says, well, maybe it did evolve. Another blank page. Okay, the Biblica is a critical edition. He won it there. I already told you that, so that's the one I was telling you about. I'll tell you in a minute. They used the Leningrad, told it's older than the Ben Kayin by a century, the Aleppo, blah, blah, same thing again. The pre-Masoretic text, they said, okay, that was the Masoretes. They did this in the 500 to 800 AD period. Do we have, what was the text like before the Masoretes? They must have changed it. Oh, we don't have any manuscripts. Well, we'll find some. We'll do something. And so they said, we found these Dead Sea Scrolls, but we hadn't found them yet. They said, we got the Septuagint. Now, anybody that knew anything 50 years ago knew the Septuagint is an absolutely inaccurate, terrible translation. You go back to the antediluvian flood fathers, the Lamech and Methuselah and those guys. In the Septuagint, if the man had a baby before he was 100 years old, you add 100 years to his age. So Jared had his son at 62. That's not possible. It must have been 162. If somebody's 260 when they had, no, he went 260, you take 100 years off. You end up with the flood guys living longer than the flood, which can't happen. And they did that kind of nonsense, and that was in Genesis through Deuteronomy, and everybody says, that's the most accurate part of the translation. It goes downhill from there. But in order to justify a pre-Masoretic text, they have now decided, oh, it's not that they were a bunch of idiots who couldn't translate for the sake of their life. They had a different Hebrew Bible, and since the Septuagint is so old, if we reverse the Septuagint back to Hebrew, we can determine the pre-Masoretic Bible. And so they got that one. So we got the Septuagint. Then we got a blank screen. Do we have any manuscripts? We got one called the Samaritan Pentateuch. When the king of Assyria captured the Israelites, took them away, he brought in people from the rest of Assyria and stuck them in there. The Jews rejected them. A few Jews intermarried with them. They became the Samaritans. Because the Jews wouldn't let them worship at Jerusalem, they built a temple on Mount Gerizim. They added the 11th commandment, thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, in Mount Gerizim. And they started their own pseudo-Jewish religion. And they had their own first five books of Moses. And they said, oh, there, that's pre-Masoretic. So we get that one, and we use that one. And that's what that looked like, if you may. Then we did find the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the primary biggest Dead Sea Scroll that we have is Isaiah. And they were licking their lips. You know how the modern scholars say, well, there's two Isaiahs. There's Proto-Isaiah and there's Deutero-Isaiah. The first 39 chapters of Isaiah are different from the last 27. Hey, that number sounds familiar. The first 39, they were written by Proto-Isaiah, and the last 27, they were written by Deutero-Isaiah. I bet when we get this scroll open, we'll find a division there. And so they carefully, it took them years to open the Isaiah scroll, and they got to chapter 39, ran right into 40. And they, oh, man. But they kept going. And they found the break at chapter 56. Trino-Isaiah! Three Isaiahs! And so they built a whole theology around this, just like they built the Nebraska man around the pig's tooth. There are a few other pieces and scraps out there. And then there are the Targums. The Targums are Aramaic paraphrases, unofficial translations of the Hebrew Bible. And out of this projected, it doesn't exist, but out of this projected, created pre-Masoretic text, they found an excuse to try to change the Hebrew Bible. It's not like Greek, where we have two-tenths of a percent that are Alexandrian. We don't have any. We don't have any rival Hebrew text. We just have to invent one because we know what we have can't be what we started out with. That's the basis of Old Testament critical analysis. Where do the changes come from? I said, I got to figure this out. I got to figure this out. The first thing I did is I read the book of Isaiah, word for word, in the American Standard Version and the King James Version, and I redlined any verse that had a change of substance between the two things. Then I went back to Hebrew. You say, why didn't you start with Hebrew? I did. I started with Hebrew with seven Hebrew manuscripts, checking letter by letter, and after three chapters, I had not found one difference. Not one. I said, this is going to be a long study. So I said, well, let me work backwards from English. And so I took the American Standard, and I took the King James. You say, why didn't you use the New American Standard? Because there was so much dynamic equivalence, you couldn't tell what was literally translated. Revised Standard couldn't use it. I went back. The American Standard was literal enough I could fit. I isolated 260-plus passages where there were words that were different in English that might have come from a Hebrew word that was different. You know how many I found that actually had a Hebrew word that was different? Zero. I said, now we got a problem. What are we going to do next? So I got a commentary by Frank Gabelline on the book of Isaiah from the NIV. I figured, now this we get some academics here. And there were 267 footnotes on why the text said what it said, where it said it. I said, now we're cooking with gas. I pulled all 267 of those out, and out of the, or 276, I'm sorry, and out of the 276, 160 of them had to do with, this is what the Bomberg said, this is what we translated. I said, oh goody, I'm going to find out where the Hebrew text is different. You know what I found out? We're going through here. Zero. Zero. No differences. I couldn't believe it, and so I printed it out. Dr. Wait, you can have these papers when I'm done. I printed out 160 verses, not one difference. Now, there's differences in English, Isaiah 9:3. You've increased the nation, you have not increased the joy. You've increased the nation, you have increased the joy. That's a pretty significant difference, 180 degrees opposite direction. Where does that come from? 130 changes was the total that were verse changes. 34 of those changes were due to translational liberty. What do I mean by that? It was raining, it was a deluge. They're both rain. There's a little bit of liberty that is legitimate liberty when you're translating. That was a house. That was a dwelling place. That was a home. You can do it. And I'm not saying they were right to go that way. I'm just saying they didn't change anything to go that way. Eight of the 130 were the Ketiv versus the Keri. Thou hast increased the nation, but thou hast not increased the joy, came from the Keri Ketiv. And again, you have the one that is written, you have not increased the nation. You have not increased the joy, you have increased the joy. Now, what does the Bible say in Revelation 20, about or 22, about changing the Bible? You add to it, I'm going to add to you the place. You take away, I'm going to take away your place. I'm not too keen on helping them change it. But out of the 130, there were eight where both were written by the rabbis, and they chose the other one rather than the one we see in the King James Bible. 25 of the 130 changes, they said there's no question about the Hebrew text. Doesn't matter whether you use Ben Chaim, whether you use Ben Naphtali, doesn't matter whether it's Aleppo, doesn't matter whether London, it's all the same. It's exactly the same, but the Septuagint says something else. And we know the Septuagint is older than the Hebrew text because the Septuagint translates the Hebrew before they had a Masoretic text, so we know that this is better. And 25 times they changed the book of Isaiah, not because the Hebrew is any different. In those places, it is 100% identical between the BHS and the Masoretic text. I did not find even a vowel point out of place. But they simply said, we like the Septuagint better. And we're going to 17 times, they said, we like the Dead Sea Scroll better. There were multiple times when they chose the Septuagint that the Dead Sea Scrolls, the oldest copies of the Hebrew Bible, and the Masoretic text agreed 100% identical. And they said, the Septuagint's different, so that must have been original. Again, remember the thesis. If what you have today is the result of evolution, if a horse is an eohippus the size of a collie dog with three toes that evolved into a horse, if you got a horse today, it couldn't have been a horse, so let's go find that eohippus, early horse. And they go backwards looking for stuff. They went backwards, and if the Dead Sea Scrolls disagree with the Septuagint and the Masoretic text, then you go to the Dead Sea Scrolls. You go to the most obscure, the most unsupported answer, because that's probably the one that was original, because God's illiterate and he starts out stupid and it takes human scholars to fix it up. You say, preacher, that's unkind. I think it's unkind what they do to the Bible. 20 of the 30 changes. They said the Septuagint doesn't say it. The Samaritan Pentateuch doesn't say it. The Targums don't say it. The Masoretic text doesn't say it. But we know God could not possibly have meant what he wrote. So we'll fix what God said, and we'll tell you what God should have said if he had any good sense. And they mark it in the Revised Standard Version. They were honest enough to do it in there. There's a footnote there. It says CN. It means correction without any textual evidence whatsoever. In the book of Isaiah, there were 20 changes where they changed the translation. In the NIV, we're not talking about dynamic equivalent here. They simply said that Hebrew word, we don't like that one, we're going to translate this Hebrew word over here and change what the Bible says. 23 times they said you can't understand the Hebrew, we'll just make something up. Behemoth. We can't translate behemoth. We don't know what a behemoth was. Let's stick elephant in there, that's fine. 23 times. Where do the changes come from? They don't come from the Hebrew text. Three come from the Targums. I put an illustration here. I could say to Kate, my daughter back here, go call your brother for dinner. She could go out the door and say, come and get it. She could come out and say, dinner's ready. She could say, God says get in here right now. She said, you, here. It's all a paraphrase of what I said. What I said was, go get your brother for dinner. And all the paraphrase is wrong. Paraphrase can't tell you what the original said. Can't do it. You can't be sure any more than I could reading the New American Standard what the Hebrew said. Ben Asher was the last of a distinguished family of Masoretes who went back to the latter half of the 8th century. Despite the rivalry of Ben Naphtali and his group, the opposition of Sadia Galen, the most eminent representative of the Babylonian school of criticism, Ben Asher's Codex has been recognized as the standard text. The Jews had these discussions and they came to the conclusion that the text that became the King James Bible was the accurate text. Is that my 3 minutes? The Temple Synagogue scriptures written on scrolls, academic scriptures written on codices, books, what's Masoretic text? It's the words that rise up off of that. If you didn't have vowels, the letters GDN, DSNWHR, God is now here, if I put those vowels in, or God is nowhere, if I put those vowels in, or good snow here, if you're looking for a skiing report. If the vowels weren't in there, we were in trouble. There's pictures of the Aleppo and the Leningrad text. Text under the is the Masoretic text, rabbinical rules. The Bible of Daniel Bomberg had rabbinic notes written around the outside, some technical terms that don't mean anything to you. What I found, none of my expectations. There was no significant difference between BHS and the Masoretic text. I couldn't believe it. Not in the book of Isaiah. I cannot tell you the other 38 books of the Old Testament. I chose Isaiah specifically. Bobby, my friend, was working on Genesis. He found the same thing in Genesis. There was no significant consonantal Hebrew text. There was no significant difference in the vowel pointing except for Jehovah over to Yahweh, which was a conscious perversion of the scriptures. The translation variants don't come from the Hebrew text. The scholars lie again. I have several questions. I don't have the answers to. There are, in the entire Hebrew Ben-Kayim versus Kittel, 7-8 differences that we were able to discover. That's all. In the whole Old Testament, as far as we could find things out. Ruach Kittel, here's the printed text we use. Why did they do it? Introduced out so you don't believe the Bible. Make you question your Bible. Here's Bob, I've got to get past all these good things. Great assumption, ever learning, never able to come. I'm back to the beginning here, yet not where I want to be. Hang on, keep going.
You can read this if you read fast, or you can get it in the book later on. Brother Wake prints it. I want to get done before my time. Here it is. Three questions I have. Number one, what original language text did our translators use? Does it matter since the Hebrew is the same? I'm not going to fight that battle anymore. They used the Masoretic text. The Masoretic text is what Bomberg printed here. There is no older and best. There is only the Masoretic text. Number two, why did they use this text? Because the rabbinic notes around the outside said this is the right text. There were arguments for the Kerry Kathib, the written and the read, in those notes around the outside that caused the King James translators to choose not rather than yes. Number three, why don't the current versions use this text? You know, if they tell us we went after the oldest and best, and we had to go to the Septuagint and the Targums and all these things to get the oldest and best, why didn't they have the academic integrity to change the Hebrew text and be honest with people? They're liars. To the core, they're liars. I'll probably get sued on that. Why they use the Bomberg? Because it's superior. That's the end of it. I'm not going to go on. But they did not. All this fuss about we need the oldest and best Hebrew text, we got to get Prima. They, after they got all this work, didn't change the Hebrew Bible, but they no longer use it to translate because they want to translate what they want to translate, not what God's Word says. Scholars lie, brother Lee. Oh, I have to read scripture, don't I?
Yeah.
And you set up a Bible up here. You know which reference I have? Who read last, so I know where to start? Where'd you end? 72, so I guess Psalm 119, verse 73. There is much, much, much more in my notes than I could possibly present. I knew I had limited time. I did not want to steal Dr. Waite's time. Thy hands have made me and fashioned me. Give me understanding that I may learn thy commandments. They that fear thee will be glad when they see me, because I have hoped in thy word. I know, O Lord, that thy judgments are right, and that thou in thy faithfulness hast afflicted me. Let, I pray thee, thy merciful kindness be for my comfort according to thy word unto thy servant. Let thy tender mercies come unto me, that I may live, for thy law is my delight. Let the proud be ashamed, for they dealt perversely with me without a cause, but I will meditate in thy precepts. Let those that fear thee turn unto me, and those that have known thy testimonies, let my heart be sound in thy statutes, that I be not ashamed. Now, you're back here, aren't you? Okay. Now, we got several things we're doing. You tell me the order and I'll do it.
Okay, you give us a hymn standing up. And
give us a hymn standing up. 560, third verse, let's stand together.
You have a special
at the end of the altar, same time.
Yeah,
okay. All right, 560.